I would like to give you, through the eyes of a trained observer, exact picture of one of these close encounters, as listed in a Federal Aviation Agency report and in the assigned report, which is in our files. Imagine for a moment that you are Captain George W. Schemmel, a veteran on Transworld Airlines. You are flying a Super Constellation over Amarillo, Texas, at a height of about 16,000 feet. It is a perfectly clear night. You can see all the way to the horizon. It's about 11 o'clock, and most of the people down in the cabin are asleep or a few reading. Half of them have their seat belts off. Without any warning, something, a glowing object of some kind, comes swiftly over the horizon. It comes towards you much faster than any aircraft we know about could possibly speed. As it makes a sharp turn in your direction, you can see flashing lights, red, green, and white, varying very rapidly. One more turn, and this object is headed straight toward the super constellation. You have no time to warn the passengers. You slam the controls down, and you dive for 2,000 feet. If you pull out, you can hear screams back in the cabin. If you pull out, turn the controls over to the first officer and go back in the cabin, and you find a real mess. About 15 passengers were thrown up against the ceiling. Two or three are lying unconscious over seats or in the aisles. Bits of luggage, packages, and so on are there. People are groaning, one or two screaming, and you manage to quiet them down. Then you go back and radio the ground for ambulances. You land, the really injured people are taken off. You reassure the others, and finally you go on with your flight. You are asked by the Federal Aviation Agency and later by the Air Force what it was. I haven't the slightest idea. It was no aircraft. This was a UFO, and this is only one of the near collisions on the airways which are on official record. One of them happened to Pan American Captain Matthew Van Winkle. He was flying from New York to Puerto Rico with a full load on a DC-6, and an object came toward him so rapidly that he didn't even have time to dive. He simply pulled the DC-6 up and stood it on his tail. Then he slammed the nose down to keep from stalling. When he threw the nose down, up went the passengers. Same thing again, Puerto Rico, ambulance was meeting the plane. Air Force said this was a fireball. Van Winkle said, I have seen hundreds and hundreds of meteors and fireballs. I'm not going to risk passengers' lives by pulling up like that for any meteor. Out on the West Coast, a United Airlines plane narrowly avoided a collision. Result, stewardess unconscious in the aisle with a skull concussion, passenger with a broken leg, and half a dozen other passengers moderately hurt. Now, these are the things which many people don't hear about. And the reason you don't hear about them, because for years we've had wild stories from kooks all over the United States and even in foreign countries. The wildest tales that you can imagine hooked up with this flying saucer business. For instance, a man in New Jersey named Howard Menger, who said he was very fortunate. He met a space girl from Venus who was down here and married her. And they were very happy for a little while, and she wrote a book by Saturnian Lover. It turned out that she'd already been married to this man on Saturn. Then there was a chap named Dan Fry, who was down near White Sands. He walked out in the desert one night. A huge flying disc landed near him, and he walked over toward it. He wasn't a bit frightened. Lots of people who see these things go the other way. He walked over, and a voice came out from the air somewhere and said, don't touch the hull, pal. It's still hot. So, then the voice continued, wait a minute, and then a door opened and he was invited aboard. There was nobody in the disc at all. It seemed it was being controlled by a very high altitude from a mothership, all remote control. So he was taken on a flight to New York, up and back in 14 minutes, as I recall. And they explained to him what they were doing, and this is wonderful. He went on a TV program shortly after that and made the mistake of taking a lie detector test. There's another chap you may have seen on television lately, Mel Noel. He says he was with an Air Force unit, he was an Air Force pilot, assigned to chase UFOs. And one day they ran into a group of these objects, and they had a colonel leading this I don't know why they had a colonel leading a flight of six jets, but anyway, this colonel began to correspond on radio with their, or rather communicate on radio with these UFO people, or whatever they were. And it was a very interesting conversation. They even told him that next Monday, if he wanted to use it, the information, that the stock market was going up. But anyway, the colonel later went and met these people secretly, and then he went up to Mars with them, and he's been organizing flights back and forth, carrying scientists, some of you people in Oak Ridge better look out, carrying American scientists and military men up there, and the Martians come down here, and they've got a base in Brazil where they're building these things, and pretty soon we're going to have a global and Martian civilization. Now, there are hundreds of stories like this, and they get worse every month. But you can see why people who have never looked into this subject are going to be misled. And as a result, many people who honestly think it's pure nonsense come right out and say so. One of them recently was the Reverend Francis Hayden, an eminent astronomer at Georgetown University. He said there are 100% hallucinations. He didn't say 99. Nobody was right. So I would like to read just a few names of some of these people who have been having hallucinations. These are all signed, documented reports in our files, and also most of them in Air Force files. Dr. Seymour Hess, a meteorologist who was at Lowell Observatory, saw a power disk daylight. Dr. H. Percy Wilkins, the expert on Mars, who saw two objects while he was in the United States. Professor Henry Carlock, head of the physics department at the University of Mississippi, who was also an Air Force Reserve colonel. He saw a UFO, an oval-shaped object, with four ports through which you could see a glowing light. He reported that. We asked him later what the Air Force said about it, and he said no comment. Captain Albert Rieda, B-29 commander of World War II. Captain Jack Puckett, Army Air Corps. Major Edmund Jerome, Army Air Corps. Captain Harold Klotz, TWA. Lieutenant Dwayne Swimley, Army Air Force. Well, they go on and on. I've got this book, incidentally, this document, called The UFO Evidence. It's prepared by our committee, and I'm going to get rid of the name immediately. It's a jawbreaker. The National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, and for short, it's NICAP, N-I-C-A-P. It was organized to carry on a serious investigation of the evidence, rule out all of the screwball reports, see if there was enough proof that something really existed, and if there was, to try to end the censorship. We have on our board of governors high-ranking military officers, scientists, experts in aviation, and various fields. We have between 250 and 300 advisors, special consultants, who will answer questions and help us in almost any field we would need connected with investigations of UFOs. So this is not any organization connected with the kooks. As the doctor said, mentioned about joining, anybody that wants to can ask me about it later. That isn't why I came here. But now, in the last year or so, many of you have probably noticed, there's been a great increase in interest and acceptance in UFO reality. At least a lot of people will go to the point where they'll say, I don't know, but I'm willing to look at the evidence. Well, here are some of the recent cases that you might consider. A report last July by Julian Sandoval, former Air Force navigator, 8,000 flying hours. He's now on the Apollo project and has been on this for about 2 years. Sandoval saw a UFO hovering near Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he took a bearing on it and tracked it for about 10 minutes, which was just barely moving, 35 miles to 40 miles an hour. And suddenly it tilted up and accelerated and went out of sight so rapidly that he said in the assigned report to us, it was making at least 6 times the speed of sound, which is over 3,600 miles an hour, on up to perhaps 4,000. Another report, Captain George Walton, a scientist in New Mexico, graduate of Columbia University. He was driving along the road in the state with his wife when two glowing discs, about 25 feet in diameter, swooped down beside their car. Mrs. Walton screamed, and the doctor didn't scream, but he stepped on it and went down the road as far as his car would make it, about 90, he reported. They dispatched them for 10 miles, and then they climbed up, peeled off, and went out of sight. Incidentally, this sighting was investigated by the chief Air Force consultant on UFOs, Dr. J. Allen Hynek. I think the main reason he went down there is because here was the brother scientist. And if a scientist was reporting these things, why, it was time to look into it. He came back and he said, this is an authentic report. They saw unidentified flying objects. Another scientist recently told us about an experience he had while driving on the Beltway around Washington. This was last August. He saw an object at a rather high altitude, which was moving too rapidly to be an echo satellite or anything. Besides, it was moving back and forth in zigzag fashion. He stopped his car at one side and watched for a few moments, and then he saw this object descend very rapidly. He lost sight of it, and he drove on a little farther and drove over on the grass. And then he saw this thing come down at a speed he later said was probably somewhere around 4,000 miles an hour. It stopped 200 feet above the ground and hovered near a house. He said he was strongly impelled to go over and take a closer look at it, but he was more strongly impelled to get in his car and get down the highway, which he did. He told the Air Force afterwards that he was literally half frightened to death. Recently in Florida, a private pilot who was 8 years with the Army Security Agency, a man named James O'Connor, was making a daylight flight in a light plane when he noticed all of a sudden he was in a very deep shadow. There had been a clear sky, so he looked up and he said he almost fainted. Here was a huge flying disc about 500 feet above him. When he tried to turn away from it, every time he turned, this thing matched the maneuver and stayed above him. And finally he said, I just hit the throttle full power and stuck the nose down and died. And he said, I didn't look back till I was down to where I had to pull out. So I looked, I could see the thing was going out of sight at a very high rate of speed. Now these are not just extraordinary cases. These are typical reports that come into us month after month at Washington. One of the latest came from the entire crew of a Canadian airliner. This was a DC-8 jet off Peru. This happened about January the 10th. They saw a light which they couldn't explain, and then as it got closer, they could see there were two bright lights with beams coming out of them in between a ring of colored lights that seemed to be flashing. This thing came down closer and closer until they could see the shape, a shape of an object which seemed to be rounded to sort of an oval shape behind the lights. This UFO faced them for a few moments and then climbed up, same story, off again at high speed. The captain, Robert Milbank, stated, I never believed in flying saucers before, but I've got to now. So you may think, well, if this is really happening, why is it that all this, there's so much secrecy? Why don't they just come out in the open and put the facts on the line? Well, it's a very complicated situation. I'll go into part of that censorship later. But I wanted to make it clear, I am not attacking the United States Air Force. These people are under orders. There is a group in the project and a group on the press desk in Washington and the information office, the secretary's office, to explain away these reports when they become public as quickly as possible. They are under orders from a higher level, and in 1953, it was the CIA. The CIA said, to get rid of this danger, and you're crowding communications, and we're having a lot of trouble here, debunk these. Get rid of them any way you can. I think the evidence indicates that the CIA is still giving the orders, possibly the National Security Council. So when you hear people say, well, the Air Force is lying or giving false answers, you're talking mainly about a group of men down there extremely unhappy about it. They say, well, when we put out these answers, we know nobody's going to believe them, and one of these days it's going to blow up in our face. Now, as I said before, there's been a great increase in acceptance by the public. The Gallup poll shows 46% of the American people believe in the reality of UFOs. That doesn't mean they believe they're interplanetary spacecraft, but they believe they're real. They don't accept the official answers. And one thing that has helped bring this about has been the very great increase in close approaches and touch landings within the last year and a half. When I say touch landings, I'm not referring to these again, the wild stories that you hear, like a woman down in Silver Spring named Madeline Rutherford. She says that the spacemen land in her backyard regularly. They come in for, she said, supper, come in for supper, and sometimes stay overnight. And she has a great time. The worst of it is she gets on television with these stories. And there was another chap who had an even wilder tale and got him into trouble, a man named Truman Bethram. He was a contractor and he was out on the desert. I don't know why half of these people are always out on the desert when they see these things. But anyway, it was kind of hot and he decided to sit out there and get cool off. And he, all of a sudden, just landed nearby. And he watched it. Door slid open. Out came a beautiful space lady. Turned out her name was Captain Aura Raines, and she was in command. And this thing came from the planet Clarion, which you never heard about, or at least never seen, because it's always on the other side of the sun. Astronomers say they don't know how that happens, but anyway, that's where it came from. So she and Bethlehem had quite a conversation, and this went on, and night after night, they had these very, very animated conversations, got to know each other quite well, until Mrs. Bethlehem said she was not going to play second fiddle any space girl suiting for divorce. But that kind of thing, landings, there must have been 50 people in the last year who've reported having things land near them and various types of space creatures come out. And I'm talking about things like this. A report by a NASA space agency engineer named E.G. Crimmins and Major John Nayadley, Air Force retired, who was also an engineer with the space agency. These two men reported seeing a disc-shaped object with a rotating rim and flashing lights come down and touch ground briefly near Hampton, Virginia. Now, Crimmins reported this to the Air Force. Shortly after that, an investigator from Langley Field came over and said, "You sure you didn't see a helicopter?" Well, I ought to know a helicopter, being in the space agency this long. And then they asked Nayadley the same thing. He said, "Well, I've flown helicopters besides jet aircraft, and if I can't tell the difference, they better put me in St. Elizabeth or somewhere." So newspapers came out. This was a helicopter. Down in Pretoria, South Africa, about a year ago, two constables were patrolling in a police van shortly after midnight. They saw an object about 40 feet in diameter resting on the highway straight ahead of them. Their lights fell on it, and they slowed down and then decided to go in and investigate. They closed in to about a quarter of a mile, and this object lifted from the ground a few feet, and then an exhaust flame blasted straight down, and the object rose very rapidly and then went off on a horizontal angle and disappeared. Where the exhaust flame had hit the highway, which was Macadam Road, there was a hole 6 feet in diameter, and the tar in the Macadam was on fire, and it blazed for 3 hours before they could put it out. This was confirmed by the commandant of the district, a Colonel G.H. Britt. And he stated that this was a highly important matter and it was under a top secret investigation. And that's all we've ever been able to get out of that one, except that it happened. Down in the Everglades about 9 months ago, a man who trains dogs and also has a ranch nearby was in the glades with his swamp buggy, and he saw an object land, a very strange object, and he went over toward it. His dogs were raising such a fuss that he tried to keep them locked in the swamp buggy. But he got near this thing and he could see that it was a cone-shaped object. It wasn't the usual disc shape. There have been several of these huge cone-shaped objects reported within the last year and a half. It was a cone-shaped object, which he estimated about 75 to 100 feet across the base and 60 feet high. There were four tiers of what could have been ports or at least apertures of some kind, but he could see nothing inside. He could see just a little glow behind each one of these little square sections. As he came near this, he put up his hand to shield his eyes from this brilliant glare. And according to his signed report and what he told our investigators, that was the last he remembered. When he came to, he had a very deep gash over one eye, could see out of that at all, and he could barely see out of the other. After a number of hours, he managed to get back to his swamp buggy and went to a Seminole village, and they took him into a hospital at Fort Myers. The chief of police in Fort Myers the editor of the local paper, most of the leading citizens down there all swear that if this man, Flynn, said it happened, it happened. But that isn't enough. You can't accept that as evidence. After he got out of the hospital, he led a search party back into the Glades, and they found an area with a circular scorched spot 70 feet in diameter. They found broken limbs 35 feet above the ground, and they found charred limbs. It looked as though something had come straight down, scraped down to this spot and hovered there or just above the ground. There was not a sign of anything in this scorched area, any rock or anything. It was completely flat. The doctor who treated Flynn said that he had deep muscle injuries and other effects which could not have been the result of a hoax. If he wanted to do all this and hit himself over the eye and create a hoax, he still couldn't have caused this other thing. So that there was another case, a recent case, indicating strong proof that something or other is coming in and landing, briefly landing on this earth, taking off again and observing us. Now, quite often when these reports are made public, it ends in unfortunate ridicule for the witnesses. Two Texas deputy sheriffs sighted an object on September 3rd, 1965, down near Damon, Texas. They approached an area where they could see an object with a brilliant purple light in the nose and a faint blue light at the end. They saw this thing come down toward them, and they could see the shadow on the ground because it was bright moonlight. It was a bright moonlight night, and they could see very clearly this long oval shape. Deputy Sheriff Robert Good was in the driver's seat. He was leaning out, trying to see back of the glow with binoculars. It was so blinding that the ground was lit up with this purple light, and it even lit up the inside of the car. He reported that when the object was some 75 yards from him, he could feel a sudden intense heat, at which time he dropped the binoculars and put the car in motion. And in the signed report by him and the other deputy sheriff, they state they went down the road 110 miles an hour. This is what they told the Air Force, and we have a copy of the report to the Air Force, in which they described this. And the major from Ellington Air Force Base, with the team that came in with this major, they told these men that they had definitely seen a UFO, and was nothing else could explain it. Out of Dayton, the chief of the project, Major Robert Quintanilla, said that they had been deceived by the Star Antares. So here we have two deputy sheriffs who'd been in shooting scrapes, a really tough lawman down there, and they took a look at the star and raced down the road 110 miles an hour. But we gave a friendly newspaper man in Washington the report on this. And he went out to the project and said, I think you had better recheck this because there's some evidence this was not a star. So Quintanilla looked into it and called down there. He had never talked with these men before, and after a while he said, yes, you're right, it wasn't Antares at all. So it's an unsolved case. But down in Dayton, down where these men live, they're still being ridiculed. Seen any flying saucers lately? So this is an unfortunate situation, but it results from the general fear of the result if all of the information is made public. Now, back of this mass evidence, when I speak of mass evidence, I mean over 10,000 reports in our files, about the same number in the Air Force files, and some of them duplicates, of which at least 20% are from the best possible observers, pilots in all the armed forces, on all the major airlines, astronomers, control tower operators, scientists, engineers, and good solid citizens all around the country, as well as the same abroad. These reports have revealed a lot of remarkable information. First of all, they show that the majority of things seen by these people were disks. They're apparently metallic. They have a diameter 10 times their thickness at the center. They're capable of hovering and accelerating at incredible speeds, from hovering up to several thousand miles an hour within seconds, which seems to defy all natural laws. They can make right angle turns without banking. They can hover and reverse. They can go straight up. In one case, one was recorded on height finder radar as going up about 5,000 miles an hour before it went out of range. Now, all of these things have been confirmed by radar scopes and visual reports by credible observers. For instance, the case of Major Charles Scarborough, the United States Marine Corps. Scarborough was a jet pilot. He was in the reserve at this time. He was a lawyer down in Dallas. He still is. He had four other Marine pilots out on a training mission. It was just about noon and bright, clear day, and suddenly they saw 16 discs approaching in a formation of four squares. They were keeping a very precise formation. Scarborough, who was down, I don't remember the altitude, but he was down fairly low, radioed the top man, Captain Stanton, and said, "Dive, and we'll see if we can box one in." And he radioed the others and told, "Let's get the one on the end over here, on that farther square." Stanton nosed over, and he said, "That's the last I ever saw of them." And Scarborough, in describing the way they went out of sight, said, "They flew at an unreasonable speed." The speed was later computed to be at least 10,000 miles an hour. And a lot of people read that and said, "Well, that's ridiculous. Marine or no Marine pilot, I don't believe it." Well, it went up to Navy headquarters. The Marine Corps got it, then the Navy, and they had to turn it over to the Air Force. The Air Force, following orders from the CIA, we never heard of it. So I got a hold of Scarborough, and he gave us a signed report and said, "I gave it to the Navy," and they told me they turned it over to the Air Force, and they had no answer. Now, one of the best cases I know confirming the disc type of UFO was relayed to our committee by Admiral Delmer Farney, former head of Navy guided missiles. Admiral Farney was at one time head of our group, the chairman of our committee, and he also one of our special advisors. This report described an encounter over the Atlantic. Some of you here, I know there's at least one young lady here who's a member of NICAP, so she knows that. I hope you all have read this case, because I had it in one of my books. But at any rate, perhaps I can give you a few details that weren't in there. A Navy transport was flying back from Europe, returning several Navy aviation crews after foreign duty. They were flying at 19,000 feet at about 100 miles out of Gander, Newfoundland, when the crew in the cockpit spotted lights down on the surface or close to the surface of the water. The commander banked to spiral down and take a look, at which time these lights spread out very rapidly, except for one, which came up toward the transport at incredible speed. As it reached their level, it could be seen as a giant flying disc with a diameter which practically all aboard this plane later estimated four times the wingspan of the Super Constellation, about 350 feet in diameter and 30 feet thick. It had a fluorescent, bluish-green glow around the rim. This object came straight toward the transport, and the three-striper, the commander of the plane, said he was paralyzed, which was a good thing, because if he tried to move the controls, he might have hit it. At the last moment, the object flipped up on edge and went by the wing, and he came back in a few seconds and faced them for about 10 seconds, and then tilted up and went out of sight. Now, this was seen by practically everyone aboard the plane, including 11 pilots. When they got to Gander, Air Force Intelligence interrogated them separately and then together. They got down to Patuxent, Maryland, Naval Intelligence took over. Each man was required to state his opinion of what it was they had seen. Most of them said, "We've seen something from some other civilization." 2-3 days later, a scientist from a top agency in Washington came down with some secret photographs, and the commander identified one of these as practically the same as the thing that they had almost hit over the Atlantic. But when he asked questions about it, they said, "Sorry, all I do is ask questions, I don't give answers." Now this is typical in all interrogations, official interrogations. They will not say anything to you, no matter how, even if you're high up in the military service. There was another case, another disc case, which I think is interesting because the Air Force confirmed this officially to me in writing, and that was the encounter by Captain W.B. Nash, Pan American Airways. He is now a senior Pan American captain flying F-727 jets over Germany, and he's on a special assignment carrying high government officials, VIPs. So they don't think that he's any crackpot. Nash and his co-pilot saw six 100-foot discs glowing red and orange red, approaching beneath them. They were flying at 6,000 feet altitude, 8,000, and these objects were about 6,000 below. When they started to bank to take a look, the objects all flipped up on edge and then made a violent change of course, flattened out, accelerated to very high speed, and disappeared. Now, this was confirmed by Air Force radar, also by Navy witnesses on the ground. Major Dewey Fournay, who was then the monitor of the project and is now on our Board of Governors, told me this was one of the best, most thoroughly documented cases the Air Force had. They checked every possible explanation and they had no answer. 2 years ago, the Air Force labeled this insufficient information and wrote it off as explained. The second shape that has been revealed by the evidence is sometimes called cigar shape, but that's misleading because it's more usually a very thick oval, something like the old type blimp. We have a report from the commanding officer of the commander of a squadron aboard a Navy carrier. He had seven attack planes with him, and they were merely going through routine exercises over the Atlantic when they saw this huge oval-shaped device up above them. It was keeping even with them, about 1,000 feet above, and they could see no sign of propulsion. Well, the skipper got on the radio and called everybody and said, "Let's spread out and let's try to get up there around it. Don't go up right underneath it, but get around it, see what we can find out." As they started up, this thing tilted around at a very sharp angle and then blasted an exhaust about 50 to 60 feet long out of the tail and then spread like that. Now, if this had stayed in the position it was when the nose went up, it certainly would have knocked two or three of these Navy planes out of the sky. They went back to the carrier, landed, reported it. Air Force intelligence men were out there in 30 minutes. All these men were ordered never to reveal it to anybody, not to discuss it with anyone. The reason I get these things is because we have a lot of contacts in the services, and I have classmates, fairly high rank, who don't believe in the secrecy, and they say it's not right, and we're not going to follow any order like that. So that's how this case was given to us. We can't use the officer's name. He said if he can get all the men who were involved that night or that day, he will sign his name. But he's coming up to Admiral. He doesn't want to stop at Captain. A more recent case occurred a year ago on the run from Anchorage to Tokyo. A Flying Tiger airliner was about 250 miles out of Tokyo when radar picked up three objects keeping position exactly five miles off one wing. Now, this plane was carrying military personnel, including an Air Force captain, who was a courier from the State Department. They called the captain up because he was an experienced navigator and asked him his opinion and also if he could estimate the size. So we're using the 5 mile radar range. He and others in the compartment took their hands and encased these oval-shaped objects, which they could see very plainly with their fingers like this. And they estimated, depending on the size of the fingers and so forth, somewhere between an inch and a half, 2 inches long. When you reduce that, and you get something that is close to 2,000 feet in length, you have three objects which everybody aboard this Flying Tiger airliner believed was each of these objects was 2,000 feet long. These things paced the plane for 20 minutes and then tilted up and went out of speed, at a speed which they tracked. They figured it out pretty closely at about 1,250 knots. We have the signed record on that, the flight, names of two or three of the people who were aboard and also saw it. That's never been made public by the Air Force. You all probably, or most of you, are familiar with the incident at Exeter, which is in a book called The Exeter Incident by John Fuller, describing how an object came down over Exeter, or near Exeter, New Hampshire, and two police officers saw it, and another witness. They saw the thing hovering about 50 feet in the ground at one time. It was down below the tree level. It hovered for some 20 minutes. One of the police officers was about to fire at it, and then he thought better of it, jumped in the car and radioed for help. When this was made public, Major Quinton Ellis said, without getting on the phone, asking anything, "Stars and planets." Well, the officer said, I was in the Air Force for 4 years. And if I haven't learned how to recognize a star on a planet, they better get me off the police force. So after a lot of agitation, and Quentin Nell, I understand, blamed NICAP for that, because we have our investigator up there, one of our men, who proved that this thing was real. It was something hovering down low, and it had pulsating lights, which pulsated in sequence, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and back. So the Air Force withdrew this answer, and they said it was a refueling operation for jets. So here we had a jet hovering for 20 minutes, 50 feet above the ground up at Exeter. Which would be a surprise to most jet pilots. So then finally, after a lot of pressure, they admitted that it wasn't that. They took it away and said that the police officers involved had written in and protested to the Air Force and said, we are being constantly ridiculed about this report. And you know those aren't the right answers. Will you please take us off the hook? So the Air Force wrote and said, if certain conditions are met, then you're right. But they never published it. It was never put out on the wires or anything. So these men are still getting a laugh most of the time. Now, there are cases of huge devices, usually the oval-shaped devices, discharging small units which may be remote control, probably are observation units. We've had a number of those cases. We're investigating them. I don't say that we accept them completely, but some of them come from veteran pilots in the armed forces. Now, all of this is not merely confined to the United States. It's in a global pattern. We have reports from practically every country in the world. We even have some reports from behind the Iron Curtain, which the Air Force collected with the help of British intelligence. And we're also getting them down at NICAP from several governments. Now, the Argentine government sent us a report recently from the Navy Ministry, and they described how one of their ships was having trouble with its compasses, and suddenly they spied this huge UFO 2,000 meters away. I don't remember the exact conversion for 2,000, but it's over 2,000 meters is over 6,000 feet. This influence, this electromagnetic interference reported, was so strong that it knocked out the compasses, every compass on this ship. And the ship was checked afterwards. All the compasses were found to be in perfect order. This is simply one little bit of evidence from a foreign country. We've had hundreds of reports from Brazil, Argentina, Venezuela, Australia, Turkey, South Africa, and the same picture over and over again. Australia had one very interesting case. A pilot of a Sea Fury radioed into his station and said, there are two strange objects flying wing to with me. So they radioed back and they said, make a 360. He made a 360 degree turn. They said, yeah, we know who, you're the one in the middle. So they accepted that. This is an official report. The Australian Navy put it, logged it. There was one in Brazil where a Brazil airliner flew right square into a formation of about 19 discs. And they were so brilliantly glowing that the passengers could see these as the first disc started around the plane. And everybody ran amok. One woman passenger ran up into the cockpit and tried to grab the controls, and she'd never flown before. I don't know what the idea was, but anyway. The report we got said the co-pilot regretted, but he had to pick up a fire extinguisher and throw in the head. Now, the Brazilians were very much upset because somebody started the idea that these were secret American devices, which we were testing all over the world, and we had quite a little trouble convincing them that we not only didn't have anything like that, we certainly wouldn't be testing them down there. But there have been many such things. There was a case where an RAF pilot, broad daylight over Sussex, was climbing up to join two Meteor jets. He was flying a Meteor jet. He saw two discs circling around these jets, and when he looked back after watching them, here was a third disc coming right straight toward his Meteor. He said it was just at the distance when he first saw it, it filled the wingspan. And he sat there paralyzed like the Navy pilot over the Atlantic. The thing flipped by, and he said it had a typical shape, like two bowls or pans, one inverted on top of the other, a typical flying saucer description, with a sort of a dome on top. He said, I was so upset I had to fly around several times before it calmed down. That's a typical British report. But now, if all of this is just a fraction of the evidence, if all this is true, if you accept it, then the natural question comes, are there remote control, or are there any beings inside these things? And if so, what kind of beings? Well, everybody who is conducting a serious investigation has sheared away from that, or veered away from it, because the minute you start talking about beings, you run into the same trouble. Trouble like this. A man named Adamski, who was the first wild man connected with UFOs, and he said that a spaceship landed near him on the desert, and a golden-haired space boy came out, and they conversed telepathically for a while, and then in broken English, and finally, the spaceman pointed down to his feet, and after he left, Adamski saw indentations in the sand from cleats on the bottoms of this spaceman's shoes, and the friend he just happened to have some plaster of Paris, so they poured it in and got these. And later they got some cryptologists, and they were able to decipher the message. It was a space message for the Earth, but Adamski said he was not allowed to reveal it. Well, now, if these beings that have been described in various people vary anywhere from hairy creatures, very frightening looking, to 12-foot giants, one up in Garson, Canada, to a very, very handsome spaceman up in Detroit. There was a woman up there. Well, her first name was Laura. I won't go any further than that. But anyhow, she was engaged to a fellow I knew slightly. He was interested in the UFO subject. And she broke the engagement. And I was there when he told me he was having trouble about it. She said, I'm sorry, but she said, since I have met the spaceman, she said, I realized that I would never be happy with anyone living on Earth here. She said, Earthmen have a lot to learn. So she broke the engagement. I mentioned these comic incidents just to show you that it goes on constantly, so that you'll be prepared to differentiate between the kooks and the deluded people and the serious observers. Now, the evidence, even though it doesn't show anything about beings, we know of no cases that have been verified, documented, where anyone has seen a space being. It may have happened, but we don't know it. But here's some things that has been proved. Electromagnetic interference, which I mentioned before. There have been hundreds of cases where UFOs have come down at relatively low altitudes and knocked out TV, radio, car ignition, sometimes car headlights.
How well substantiated do you feel that is?
All of these are substantiated. For instance, the case of the Illinois State Police. Well, one report from the Illinois State Police that the name, location, a UFO came down a relatively low altitude near Danville, I think was the city. They took out after it, and they kept going on different roads to try to keep somewhere near it. And every time they got within a half a mile of it, out went the radio. They couldn't get back. The ignition cut out. Two California State Police had the same thing happen to them. They had to go off and call their headquarters. Headquarters said, yeah, Air Force radar's got it. And report when you get back. There's too many of these things. It's happened on the airliners. The Venezuelan airliner had a direction finder and two receivers burned out. There have been cases of minor blackouts, power blackouts. Now, as soon as the great blackout happened on November 9th, 65, we were deluged with calls and wires, queries. Could the UFOs have caused this? And I thought, well, certainly not. So I went right out on a limb and said I didn't think it was possible. Whereupon one of our chief advisors, who was an electrical engineer, said, well, I wouldn't be too hasty about this. It turns out that there were sightings that night, right over the area where these things, where the blackouts began. I said, well, that still is just coincidence. But then the answer came that all this was started by a failure of the failure of a relay up in Ontario. And we've had several engineers checking on this, and one of them has been down talking to the Federal Power Commission. And they don't, to this day, know exactly what happened. They merely say, well, apparently a relay went out, and we do know there was an escalation along the grid that built up, and everything went out, despite all the safeguards they're supposed to have. But this chief advisor in electrical engineering said, if one little thing could do that in Ontario and cause the escalation, then a minor blackout by a UFO could do it. Well, I still don't accept it. I say that that was probably the way it was described. But I'll tell you this much, it's being investigated all over again. And one scientist who's interested in it is Dr. James McDonald, University of Arizona, who was greatly instrumental in getting the science of the Colorado Project underway. He doesn't say, I believe it, but he said, I can see how it could have happened. Now, there were about six blackouts shortly after that. There was one in St. Paul. Two areas went out as UFOs came down at low altitude. There was one in Brazil. There was one in Italy. There were two in Texas. And all of them were for minor causes, but escalated on the grids. So maybe that's nothing, but at least there is electromagnetic interference, which does have some effects. And one strange thing about this electromagnetic possibility is that they have now found that it is possible to hear electromagnetic waves. Now, this comes from Professor Clyde Ingalls of Cornell University. He's been conducting tests for quite a long time. He has taken subjects, and they must have quite a bit of nerve, too, and puts them in the edge of a radar beam. And then they move in gradually, not too close to center because you can get killed that way if you stay long enough. But you come in and then they begin to hear strange sounds. And they don't hear them through the ears. They seem to be coming from some sort of vibration up here at the top of the forehead. Well, he's conducted quite a number of tests and he's convinced that this is true. And I've seen other discussions recently which could explain why every once in a while animals seem to run wild when UFOs are in the area and down low, even though the animals are inside of buildings and can't see anything. This happened up at Exeter, where the report showed cattle, horses, dogs, all of them pinned up inside, where the horses were kicking the stables, their stalls, and the dogs were howling and so on. These are just interesting little items, but they are on the record. Now, there's one thing has been brought up repeatedly, and that is the radar. What time did we get started? I don't want to run over this. All right. Many people have said there never has been a single radar case. The Air Force recently told an Armed Services Committee down on Capitol Hill they did not have a single unexplained radar case. Dr. Hynek, the number one consultant, knocked the ground out from under them by coming out shortly afterwards in Science Magazine, said they had many unexplained radar cases. Now, here's one that happened down at Cape Kennedy. A Polaris missile had just been fired, and it dropped the first stage. And suddenly, radar picked up a huge target, blip. Some unknown object which had come in from a high altitude down to the same altitude as the Polaris. The automatic tracking radar immediately shifted over to track the UFO, and for several minutes, they lost track of the Polaris. I was down there giving a talk 3 years ago, and one of the officials down there gave me a copy of the report, which says for official use only. But he said, don't worry about that. It has no legal status. Just go ahead and mention it anytime you want to. There's a case at Washington years ago where these things were tracked by radar seen visually from the tower at Andrews Air Force Base and Washington National, planes in the air and triangulated by radar at three different locations. In one case, a UFO was speeding at 130 miles an hour across the river from Andrews toward National. It accelerated in 3 seconds to 7,200. Now, I got that report from a man in the tower and later the control center, which is over at another location, confirmed they had exactly the same speed. Now, sometimes we have been asked if there's any danger connected with these things. And one of the possible danger is occasionally they might be radiations. The former head of the project said, yes, there have been cases where we have found radiation when these things were down close. Down in Virginia, Grottoes, Virginia, an object landed and was on the ground for a few moments. And later, two DuPont Company engineers came in and checked it with Geiger counters and said it was very hot. It was extremely radioactive. One pilot was warned by the Air Force after he was circled very closely by three objects near New Mexico to watch his health, and if he developed any symptoms of radiation sickness, to let them know immediately and then get into a federal hospital. I thought that was just a little bit too much, because how in the world could he get that from the swift circling of his plane? But anyway, this was an ex-Navy pilot with a very fine war record, and he's a sales manager of a huge tool plant out on the West Coast. I'm going to skip a little bit because I know we're getting late, and we can bring up some of these points in the question period. The matter of propulsion is certainly going to be mentioned here. I can only say that the explanation for these things being able to maneuver and make violent turns and accelerate at high speeds in our atmosphere, according to our advisors and some people outside, is that they must have an artificial gravity field. Now, this used to be the great science fiction writer's dream, the gravity shield. But here are people that think it's possible. Hermann Oberth, who was the co-designer of the V-2 rocket, which bombed London. William Lear, builder of the Lear jet, an electronic genius, and who is now also building space equipment. Dr. Robert Forward with Hughes Aircraft, who has spent 2 or 3 years at the University of Maryland studying gravity with the hope that someday they will be able to find out how to control it. Grover Loney years ago said that he was convinced this was the answer. So did Bell of Bell Aerospace. I've checked into this and found out that the government has 46 open projects on various phases of G. And undoubtedly, from what I learned, there must be at least that many secret projects. A lot of money is being spent. So maybe it'll take us years to get the answer, but if we do, it's going to revolutionize not just air travel or space travel, but many things here on Earth. The majority conclusion at NICAP, by our board of governors and most of our consultants, is that these things are real, they're under intelligent control. There cannot be any secret weapons on Earth because their speeds and maneuvers are beyond anything that we're even dreaming about. Some of the people who have made open statements are Admiral Farney, whom I mentioned, former head of guided missiles. He said, it appears from the evidence that these objects are coming into our atmosphere from somewhere else under intelligent control. The way they change positions in formation indicates they must be controlled. Colonel Joseph Bryan III, on our board of governors, former special assistant to the Secretary of the Air Force, says that he is aware of hundreds of cases where these things have been sighted, photographed, tracked by radar. They are interplanetary, and the secrecy is wrong, and it is dangerous. People agreeing with him are Dr. Leslie Kaber, at the University of Southern California, Lieutenant Colonel Howard Spann, commanding officer of the National Guard base at Battle Creek, and scores of other people who should know. Now, the only reason for secrecy seems to be fear of alarming the American people, because the Air Force does not have all the answers. They don't know what's back of this. They don't know the motives. They don't know whether there's any hostility or not. It might be, but the evidence indicates so far that there is not any hostility. This has been going on for a long time. And even though three Air Force pilots have lost their lives chasing these things, and there have been deaths elsewhere on the ground where people got too close to them, these could be accidents. There is only one other reason, or there are two other reasons why the Air Force is in the spot about the secrecy, aside from their being under CIA orders. They have been denying this so long that when they admit it, they're going to be jumped on by the press and the public, and particularly Congress. Speaker McCormick told me about 4 years ago that even he couldn't get anything out of the Air Force in a closed session about this, but he was assured there was nothing to it. One other reason is that several times the Strategic Air Command has launched bombers against Russia when radar scopes showed what appeared to be formations of objects approaching the United States from that direction. Now, the error was found and the bombers were recalled. But we have some Strategic Air Command people in NICAP. And one man said this could very easily build up. The Russians know that we launch. They get signals from agents here or near other bases abroad. We pick them up on our radar, We keep going, and if the UFOs are still there, they confuse the picture still farther, and somebody presses the missile button, and you've got World War III. The people who signed that warning, it went to the Pentagon, included Vice Admiral R.H. Hillenfelder, former head of the Central Intelligence Agency, and all these other people who I just mentioned, and believe that it is serious enough that they should end the secrecy, inform all defense personnel of the difference between UFO characteristics on radar to avoid any more risk of accidental war. But whether or not you believe in UFOs, this one danger remains. So you do have a stake in that, if you do believe in them. And if it proves later that these things are interplanetary and they're coming from somewhere else, from a more advanced civilization, the day or shortly afterwards that we make any connection, communication with an advanced race like that, will change the lives of everyone on this earth. Thank you. Time later for a very warm welcome here to Mrs. Kehoe and myself. Incidentally, she is no stranger to Knoxville. Her grandfather lived down here years ago and was known as an engineer. He built railroads and a lot of other things. Mr. James Wilson, and she has known enough people down here. She said, "Look, when I got this invitation to go down to Oak Ridge," she said, "that's why I want you to accept immediately." Thank you for the welcome. And now we'll see what we can do with the slides, please. This is an artist drawing based on the official report in South Pretoria, South Africa, of the object which blasted the hole in the highway. It is a fairly faithful rendition of the scene as they described it. The object was about 40 feet in diameter and had this raised area, and the exhaust went straight down and for about 50 feet, and then after that, why it ceased touching the highway. Next, please. Well, that doesn't show too much. Now, this is a photograph taken at Beaver County, Pennsylvania, 1965. The object to the left is the moon. The purpose was to get a still picture of the moon, and just as the photographer was taking one of these shots, this object appeared over some trees and then came down in front of the trees. They don't show on this sketch, but they enabled us to figure the approximate size. It was presumably about 50 feet in diameter, possibly smaller. Now, that white area underneath was not seen visually. It was caught on the film. The object that was seen visually is shown on that little box down at the corner. This photograph was evaluated by four photographers in Beaver County. And then it was evaluated by our chief photographic advisor. They all agreed that this was not a hoax film. We had an investigator out there for weeks checking on the whole thing and checking into the reputation of the photographer and two other witnesses who were present. And as far as we can tell, this is a genuine photograph. Next, please. This is another artist's rendition of a signed report by four Rocketdyne engineers taken out at the, I think it's the Cayuga County, or the Cayuga facility of Rocketdyne out in California. They described this oval-shaped object as shining, going very brightly, as if it were polished aluminum, and the two smaller devices keeping perfect position, in a precision formation. The three objects moved across the valley and then tilted up and climbed out of sight at a speed which these engineers wouldn't even estimate. But the speed at which it crossed the valley, they said, was at the very least 5,000 miles an hour. Next, please. This is an artist sketch of the encounter over the Atlantic by the Navy transport. It merely shows the approximate size of the disc as reported by the crews, four times the wingspan of the transport. Next, please. Now, this one, I think, is the most important thing that we've got our hands on out of the Air Force. This is an official Air Force intelligence sketch, which was contained in Air Force Manual 200-3. It was circulated secretly to all Air Force intelligence officers with a notation, "We must be on guard against technological surprise." Now, this shows two discs coming in toward an Air Force bomber. At the time that they were circulating this secretly to Air Force intelligence officers, they were putting out a public report called Special Report 14, in which they said, we have examined over 3,800 sighting reports. Only 12 had enough detail for us even to visualize the object seen. None of the 12 agreed. Therefore, it is impossible to make even a rough model of what one of these things looks like. So intelligence officers know what they look like, but the public doesn't. That was given to us by an Air Force colonel. And the circumstances were, it was security restricted. And he came up and he said, I am very much concerned of this secrecy. And he's a member of NICAP. He said, this was security restricted, but that no longer exists, that classification. And somebody just woke up to it and they'd given orders to have it moved up to secret. But it's still unclassified. So here it is. Copy it, give it to the newspaper. So we did that, and I was told later by a friend of mine over in the Pentagon, they said, well, we finally got NICAB. We got them for violating national security. Then they looked again, they said, oh, no, we haven't either. And then afterwards, they said, well, there's nothing to prevent an artist from drawing his conception of what one of these things looks like, and that's the only explanation as to how they happen to have this being circulated to every Air Force base in this country, United States Air Force base here and abroad. Next, please. Now, that's not very clear, but that is a sketch drawn by an artist which follows an official report, which is one of the few accepted by the Air Force. This happened out in Socorro, New Mexico, where a police officer named Lonnie Zamorro was chasing a speeder, and he saw something over one side, and he went over to take a look. There was a dynamite shack nearby, and he thought somebody might be tampering with it. He saw what he said later, he thought he saw two figures scurrying around this thing. The next thing he noticed was that it was moving, and then the object blasted an exhaust flame from below and climbed up to about 25 or 30 feet and went off in a horizontal direction, just clearing the ridge. The Air Force investigated this, and I thought, well, it's simply a one-witness report, and they will knock it down. Strangely enough, this is one case which they said they couldn't explain. Dr. Hynek went down and interviewed the police officer and said there wasn't any question about it. The man was honest. He was telling the truth as he saw it. And finally, the Air Force spokesman, Major Maston M. Jacks in the Pentagon, said, Policeman Zamora saw an unidentified vehicle. This does not prove it came from outer space. Next, please. This is the much-advertised Avro disc, which was first conceived up by the Avro company up in Canada. The Air Force released this glossy picture of an artist's sketch in 1955. The Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary Quarles, said, soon people will be seeing this and other objects like it, disc-shaped objects, and they will be reporting flying saucers. We thought we had better tell them. This was 1955, remember. In 1955, they had not even built a mock-up of this thing in Canada. 2 months after this came out, two people in Ohio were terrified, and the children were terrified, when a disc came down and hovered near their home. They didn't say anything about it for a week or two, and finally a friend got in touch with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and an Air Force intelligence major came over and showed them this sketch. They said, what you saw was a secret test of this Avro disc. They got off course. They shouldn't have been down here. They're supposed to stay in Canada. But that's what you saw, and we would like to have you sign this statement here agreeing that that's what you saw. Which, of course, would have made them keep still, because if it was a secret device test, they would have to shut up. They wouldn't sign it. Later, they gave us a signed report on this. We sent it to the Air Force, and the Air Force said, we never heard of this before. There is such an officer at Wright Pat, but he has never been in this Ohio city. But to go on with this thing, about 7 years later, they finally completed a model. It wouldn't fly. So they changed it. They worked on it another year or so. Finally, we got a copy of a write-off report from a friend in the Army. The Army had withdrawn its funds. It said this thing is wildly uncontrollable and will only lift 2 or 3 feet off the ground. If it's tethered, it's safe enough, but that's as high as we can get it. The Navy withdrew. The Navy withdrew its funds, and finally the Air Force withdrew its funds, and this thing was killed cold, and the highest it ever lifted was 4 feet. The statement in 1955 was that this object would rise vertically, it would attain a speed of 1,500 miles an hour, it would make right-angle turns without banking or anything else. In spite of the fact that this was canceled, when the big excitement happened with Mars gas last year, or back in, yes, last spring, the Air Force re-released this photograph, and a lot of newspapers said probably people have been seeing secret tests of the Avro disc, which is now down at a mounted on a pedestal in a museum down somewhere in Virginia. And that's as high as it got. It's more than 4 feet off the ground because they got it up on a pedestal. Next, please. This goes back a long ways, but it has a new interest. Four discs followed a modern railway train in 1958, and they would go up to the front and then drop back, and this went on for quite a while. This was verified, and finally the Air Force asked the railroad to have these men stop talking about it because they said it was causing a little concern around the area. A year ago, we got a report from the crew, a work train crew, out near, it was in Nebraska. A disc described as about the same size and appearance came down to very low altitude and maneuvered around this train for a while and scared some of the train crew. We have several reports of that type. As a matter of fact, these things have maneuvered over cars, trucks, ships, small boats, and of course, all kinds of aerial transportation. Next, please. This is really two sketches. That section below is a cross-section of what was seen by the crew of an Eastern Airlines plane over Alabama. Captain Clarence Childs and John B. Whithead reported this thing came toward them on the airway at a speed of about 550 miles an hour. Captain Childs banked away from it, and the object veered to the other side, and they could feel the exhaust impact when it went by, whatever it was that was coming out of the tail of this thing. And it appeared to be an exhaust about 50 feet long. It rocked the DC-3. This is remained one of the unexplained cases. The Air Force admitted they had no answer for it. Even on Armstrong Circle Theater, back in 58, they had me on there with Air Force, and they cut me off when I tried to bring out some information that we had. They said they had promised the Air Force there would be no controversy. They said they admitted they had no answer for this. About 16 months ago, this was written off as a fireball. Now, that happened in 1948, so in 65, they suddenly found out it was a fireball. Okay, next, please. That may be the last one. This is really an old one, but it also has a special interest. Three objects came down near the USS Supply one clear day in 1904. The large object, the rear, has a sort of a sharp saw-like sawtooth edge, and that appeared to be flame. Some kind of flame seemed to be emanating from it, or a bright glow. This report was sent in by an officer who later became commanding officer of the Pacific Fleet. I can't think of his name, and I swear I've said it 100 times. It's Frank something, and I'll probably think of it in 5 minutes. But anyway, it's on the record, and he was Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, and he still stands by that report. I believe that is the last one. Thank you very much. And I'll try to answer questions as long as you want to stay, but I bet some of them will be from scientists here, which are going to be a little tough.
I think we have a question from down here somewhere. Yes.
I noticed you didn't mention the light scope of fully uninterrupted G journey? Have you had a chance to read it, or what do you think about it?
We not only had a chance to read it, we got the letters. We got letters from Barney and Betty Hill about a week after they had that experience, the first actual sighting. I compared them with the look story recently, and there seemed to be some discrepancies. But at any rate, we had an investigator up there off and on for a period of 2 years. He knew they were seeing a psychiatrist and going through hypnosis and everything. And we kept trying to keep the story buried because of the bad effect it might have. Well, Fuller got access to our files when he wrote Incident at Exeter, and he saw that thing in there, which made us decide not to open our files to anybody anymore. But anyway, he got this. He saw this as a big sensational story, and we tried to argue him out of it, but he wrote it. We believe these people had a frightening encounter while they were driving. They saw something that scared them, because we checked very much into their background, the type of people they were. The rest of it, I think, was a matter of tensions in their private lives, magnified by two series of hypnosis. They were hypnotized by one psychiatrist, and who knows what he did to their mental processes, and then they went to Dr. Simon, and he hypnotized them. So I would say, my personal opinion is they were not abducted. It's amazing how many women have asked me after talks, is it safe to go out at night? Are we likely to be abducted? So I don't think there's any danger from that particular source.
You don't think they actually saw people either?
I don't know. That's possible too. But the details are so sharp. If they were that frightened, I think they would have gotten in their car and gone on down the road without seeing that. I don't deny that these things could have happened. It's just that every case we've checked where they have described beings, there was something about it that didn't seem to click. And most of them, you can prove are simply not true. You want to handle Duncan?
Well, no, you go ahead. There's another question here.
Yes.
Young man.
What was that disc which never flew about 3 foot above the ground? What was it powered by?
It was a ground effect, cushion effect thing, just a blast of air driven downward. It's common enough. It was advertised years ago. There was one that showed a man standing on this thing, a little frame around it. Ground cushion effect.
And also, did they ever pick up anything from the craft, radar from the craft or any kind of radar?
What particular craft? You mean any of them?
Yeah, any of them.
Oh, yes. I think I mentioned there are hundreds of radar cases on record where radar, even triangulation, showed things to be exactly where they were seen visually and moving in the same way, same maneuvers and same speeds.
Excuse me, I think he meant, did they emit any radar radiations themselves?
Oh, is that what you... Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I misunderstood. No, there's no record of that. I don't know of any case where a UFO has given off radar emanation. We haven't any record of it.
Have they ever found any part of a spacecraft or a suspected part?
Well, down in Washington in 1952, there was a report that a piece of metal fell from one of these things during that... one of those nights when they were flying around over all the Washington buildings and so on. And this was supposed to be turned over to the Bureau of Standards, and then the Bureau of Standards was said to have given it to the head of the Canadian project, Wilbur Smith. Well, I knew Smith very well. He told me he had it. And I got up there, he sent it back to Washington. He was a brilliant engineer, and I didn't doubt his word. And yet I've never been able to find any trace of that. Standard denies it. And all the rest of these stories of crash saucers out in the Southwest, Scully's book, you know, Behind the Flying Saucers, that was pure bunk.
Thank you,
Gene. Yes.
Assuming you might assume that this censorship was a monstrous credibility gap perpetrated on the American people, especially your Republican, but... surely, what was the situation with respect to all the other countries in the What is the official position of other governments? Have they similar investigations? Are they all perpetrating the same sort of credibility gap thing on their people?
Well, first place, this has been going on over various administrations, Republican and Democrat, so you can't hang on. But several countries have security restrictions. One of them is England. For a while, they were giving out reports, and we had several reports unofficially, and we asked for copies of them, and they said, no, we've just gone under security. We can't give them to you. Norway did the same thing. We have a letter from them.
It's a worldwide conspiracy.
No, it's not worldwide because there are gaps in it. And actually, it's not... I think they're really afraid of worrying people. Now, there's been some action. People have been hurt by these things. Down in Venezuela, one night, one of these things came down low over a fishing fleet. And all the fishermen in Lake Maracaibo, all the fishermen jumped out, swam to shore. One of them didn't make it. Well, I still remember down there in that area. There have been people over in India... In Indian villages over there have been terrified. Inhabitants of islands in the Pacific, numerous cases, report. Now, they never read any books on UFOs, but when a trading ship would come in there, they were all of them terrified. Strange objects came down here and so forth. But about half the countries in the world, they might say, we don't have any censorship, but they won't give you the reports.
They do have reports.
They all have reports. Well, Brazil, for instance, had an official investigation. And the man in charge of it put out a statement saying he thought it was so serious that all nations of the world should pool their information because he said this could be something rather that would affect all of us. That was the last that was ever heard from him or anybody connected with it. And you can't get any reports from Brazil. But in contrast, the Argentine government gives us anything we ask for. We get quite a lot of information out of Australia, even though their parent country, England, won't come, won't give you anything. At Canada, the same way. For a while, we got Canadian reports by the score. And all of a sudden, they said, we turn these over to the RCAF, and they say no. I think it's merely they don't want to get tangled into this thing, the point where they have to admit to their people that these things are real, and that's all they know.
Yes. On the touchdown that you mentioned, did anyone make any attempt to make an obvious fall or rock for these things before they blasted off?
In the Pretoria case in South Africa, the samples were taken of that roadway, and we learned, not from this Colonel Brett, but we learned from another source over there that they were making exhaustive tests. We've asked for an answer, and we're going to try through the embassy now, but I don't know if we'll get the information. Now, several cases, there has been radioactivity detected. Once in Ohio, the one I mentioned down in the Everglades, and one or two other places. But there have been cases where there were indentations in the ground found immediately after one of these things was seen to touch and take off. That happened very recently up in North Dakota. The Colorado Project was so impressed by that. The Air Force said this was one of the most important cases of 1966. And immediately, Robert Lowe, the coordinator for the Colorado Project, was flown up there in an Air Force jet to check it. And I might add an interesting item there. While he was there, he found out that these camper guards that they have around the missile sites reported that dozens of times these things have come down and hovered over missile sites. They said nobody seemed to be interested, so we stopped reporting them. But now that we know that somebody's interested, we'll send them all to Colorado, so that they're getting reports by the dozens in there.
In these close encounters between aircraft and the saucer-shaped objects, do they report experiencing an air shock wave?
No, that goes into this theory of an artificial gravity field. It's obvious that there's no machine can fly in our atmosphere at speeds of several thousand miles an hour, say down at 15,000 feet, accelerate from zero on up to 5,000 or 7,000 without getting terrific heat and either disintegrating, burning. At a certain point, well, things go to pieces. If they are surrounded by a cushion, if the artificial gravity field holds air molecules around it, which is the theory explained to me by Oberth and two or three other of these people I mentioned, that would nullify the sonic boom and also keep them from heating up and having any effect on the hull. But I don't know that all of the theory, and nobody apparently knows, of how it could work. Burkhard Heim, a German scientist, worked on this for a long time, and he came as close as any to say that he could explain how these things could move without affecting anyone inside. First, beings inside would not feel any sudden acceleration, any sudden turns, or anything else. Lear said the same thing. Dr. Forward said that if the flying saucers are real, they've got to have an artificial gravity field.
In all of the early reports that you mentioned today, single observers gave velocities and dimensions and speed to things that they saw. Now, it seems clear that an object at some distance of unknown size can only be reported to angular velocity. What do these people make of the energy?
In many cases, they were down low enough that there were trees or ridges behind them, or there was radar, which gave them very accurate measurements. And then you could say it appeared the size of a quarter held at arm's length, and then you get the radar range, and you can work that out. I know what you mean. Unless you know the distance, you can't know the size, and vice versa, in a clear sky looking upward. But if you get radar triangulation, you're coming awfully close to, you can figure it out roughly. And many of these cases, there were pilots flying above, looking down on them, and comparing them with objects at the ground, and the altitude was known. There were so many cases that there wasn't any question of being able to figure it out. That one over the Atlantic, this was so close just before the thing tilted up and went by, that the commander said it just simply blotted out everything. It looked as though they were going to collide.